and welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm Laura Zara-Kopinski. I'm joined this week by Catherine Reynolds Lewis, a journalist, author, speaker, and parent educator. Her new book is called The Good News About Bad Behavior, Why Kids Are Less Disciplined Than Ever and What to Do About It. If you are on the lookout for some new parenting strategies in the new year, I think you'll really find this an interesting and useful read. Catherine Reynolds Lewis, welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm really happy to be able to chat with you today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Your book is called The Good News About Bad Behavior, Why Kids Are Less Disciplined Than Ever and What to Do About It. You're a journalist, you're a parent yourself. What got you interested in writing about behavior and diving into some of this research?
Oh, truly the most basic reason ever that I couldn't get my own kids to do what I want. And being a journalist, one of the joys of this career is that often you can just investigate the questions that are the most troubling for you personally. So I was just poking around, trying to really understand children's behavior, writing feature articles, and really just trying to understand my own children, why they did what they did or didn't do what I wanted. And the more that I dug into the research and spoke with psychologists, the more I realized that this was a broader problem than just my own home.
Mm-hmm. I found that really interesting. You were writing that you really were seeing an epidemic of misbehavior in kids today. What sort of led you to that conclusion as you were researching? And I was interested in some of the root causes you were talking about. Could you share some of that with listeners?
Right. So as I was, you know, looking at the research and also parenting and volunteering in the school, I kept hearing more parents saying, oh, she has ADHD. That's why she spaces out and you need to touch her shoulder to get her attention. Or he has anxiety. That's why he keeps asking when I'm going to pick him up every 10 minutes. And that's when, as a journalist, I started to wonder if there were higher rates of behavioral and mood disorders than in the past. And as I dug into the research, I found that indeed, yes, there are really high rates of anxiety. Nearly a third of kids have an anxiety diagnosis, and one in two children will have a mood or behavioral disorder by the time they're 18. And then when you look at some people say, oh, well, isn't this just overdiagnosis? Or maybe we're just more aware of these difficulties with self-regulation. And I say, look at the suicide rate, which in children 10 to 14 years old has doubled in the last decade. So wow. That to me is just incontrovertible that children just cannot manage their emotions, their thoughts, and their behavior the way that they could 20, 30, 40 years ago. And it's really hard to prove what's going on. But in the book, I talk about three factors that have changed in the time frame that we've seen these disorders really explode. And those factors are the disappearance of childhood play, the growth of media, technology, and an external focus. And third, that kids are really unemployed. They don't have household jobs. They're not doing chores or looking after a younger sibling, and they often don't have after-school jobs. So their work instead is to achieve, to be perfect, right? To be academics and sports and music and art superstars. And that's a really heavy burden to put on kids without giving them that chance to really contribute in a simple way to their home or their community. And all of those three factors are in laboratories and research studies associated with higher rates of attention disorders, anxiety, depression, narcissism, the other kinds of problems that are really contributing to what I call a crisis of self-regulation.
I thought hearing about those factors in particular was really interesting. And I'm curious, you mentioned the rise of media and the lack of play. Could you share just some of the ways play, you know, we're seeing real data on what a huge impact that has on kids' development. Could you talk about that a little bit, what you shared in the book?
Yeah, play is the work of childhood. It's how kids have always learned to navigate social mores. So just pushing another kid on the playground and they push back and then you fight, then you're not playing anymore. And learning how to resolve those conflicts is the first building blocks of social and emotional skills, and also even just of abstract thought. When kids scoop up a handful of mud and say, this is a cupcake, do you want to taste it? That is representing something that's an abstract idea, the cupcake, with something physical that is not that actual object. So it's just such an important foundation for kids' brain development. And often kids are supervised now. And this is true of my own children. They were in daycare from 6 months old. They were always within arm's reach of an adult who would intervene in quarrels, who would stop them from falling so that they would be safe. But as a result, they didn't develop. And kids generally aren't developing these abilities that they dearly need to survive in life. So being bored, becoming creative, resolving social disputes, and even just falling down, realizing you're okay, and getting up and brushing yourself off, that is so protective for our children against future anxiety, and just in helping them see themselves as capable and really confident people.
Mm-hmm. I'm such a big believer in that, that kid directed play. And it was interesting, around the same time I was reading your book, I was also reading a book called There's No Such Thing as Bad Weather by Linda Akison McGurk. And she's going to be on the podcast as well. And she was looking at parenting from the perspective of moving back to Sweden, where she's from. And she was describing in her book just how stark the difference was in terms of how much free play there was, and how beneficial that is. And, just how here a lot of times it feels like we, start pushing the academics so early and sometimes crowd out some of that free play. So I thought that was interesting to see in your book, some of the data around that and around the screen time as well, which we all know, I think everyone is trying to do less screen time as much as possible, but it definitely seemed like in your book, there were real pitfalls to that, that I think even more motivated me to try to limit that screen time.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to check out her book. That sounds really interesting.
So, as you were researching, you were trying out lots of the methods yourself. And I'm just curious what that process was like, and even just how long it took to write the book and gather all this, because it's really an extensive, array of different methods and research. Could you talk about some of the process?
Yeah, I'm happy to. In a sense, I started puzzling over this question when my youngest daughter was 3, and she's now 12. So, it's been something that I've been personally working on for 9 years, but I didn't really start gathering material for the book until 2012. And that was when, so my kids were in first grade and third grade, and that's sort of when, the rubber hits the road. There's more demands on the kids to sit still in school and to pay attention and to stay organized. And often they're not quite there developmentally, And so I was really trying to understand my own children, who are so different than I was. I was a bookish child. I was just happy sitting at my desk, making round dots on my eyes and beautiful crosses on my teeth.
It was me as well. I was the child requesting extra handwriting homework in preschool, even though I have terrible handwriting. So I kept keeping that in the back of my mind as I was reading, it's interesting to come at parenting from that perspective when you were that kid, but sorry, go on.
Yeah, it's so important for us to really know ourselves and realize what assumptions we're bringing to it. So that was who I was as a kid. So my own kids were so different, and I had to learn to really see them, appreciate and accept who they really were. And that was sort of my first step, but in 2012, I was really struggling with it. And I was writing an article for Washington Parent magazine about handling discipline at school being different from discipline at home. And the expert that I was quoting, Ross Green, gave me all the wonderful quotes I needed. And at the end of our conversation, just casually mentioned he was moving his family and his practice to Maine from Boston, giving up his job at Harvard and the hospital. And I was just impressed by his commitment. So I started gathering, you know, doing little interviews with principals and guidance counselors, and even a juvenile justice warden who had used his discipline model. And everyone just raved about it. It just seemed like one of these changes in perspective, new paradigm that was really transforming kids' lives. And the more I interview people, the more I really wanted to see it for myself, and flew myself to Maine, shadowed him for 4 days, and observed a school and a family that were really benefiting from his model of discipline. And that was the foundation for the article I wrote for Mother Jones Magazine about his model of school discipline that was published in July 2015. And that just went viral, which was huge for, you know, this project. It really enabled me then to sign with an amazing literary agent and, you know, finish the proposal I had started writing. And then he took it to publishers and got some competitive offers. And we picked Public Affairs, which has been an amazing home for this book. And my editor, Ben Adams, there is just great. It's been a wonderful partnership with everyone there, and also with my agent, Richard Pine. So that's sort of the short version. I'm happy to expand on any part of that process, because it was another huge learning experience for me.
I'd love to hear the backstory. The development of the apprenticeship model, which you write about in the book, and I guess sort of how you came to see that as really different from traditional methods of discipline, and some of those key takeaways that really led to that model.
Yeah, so great question. You know, when I started parenting, I myself sort of instinctively reached for the carrot or the stick when I was trying to get my kids to do what I want. And as I learned more about Ross Green's model, the parent encouragement program here in the Washington, D.C. area, and the two other models that I looked at, they were totally different. They were not focused on making kids do what you want. They were focused on building kids' social and emotional skills and their own ability to do what's needed. So it was that paradigm shift from me, the adult, being in charge and enforcing something to growing a skill that your kids have for life. And I just saw that was so much more powerful, because eventually we're not in the room with our kids, or they're off at college, and we can't control them, even if we ever could control them. And I saw that there were all these different models of discipline were using that framework really, really effectively, and in slightly different ways. And what I wanted to do in the book was to pull out the common elements that made each model work, and so people could really universalize it, see what in their parenting they're already doing that aligns with the research and what's successful, and what they might be able to add. And those three elements that I call the apprenticeship model are connection with your child, communication about the issue at hand, the tantrum or problem or disobedience that you might see as disobedience. And then third, a focus on capability building. So really trying to systematically increase our kids' ability to regulate themselves, to manage their thoughts, behavior, or emotions in whatever the context was.
Yeah, that really rang true. It reminded me a little bit. I've worked as a school librarian for a while, and we used responsive classroom. And you know, there's so many, as you're saying, there's so many different models, and that can be overwhelming. So it is. I like seeing this in terms of those three, like that idea of connection and capability. That was something we really focused on in classrooms. That idea of, you know, really building those relationships, and then, you know, it's interesting. I know this is different in the home versus the classroom. And my daughter's only a toddler, so we haven't reached that elementary age yet. But I was always so struck by how motivating it was for kids to feel like they were contributing. And in the library, that was, you know, kids getting so excited to help, you know, shelve a book or check out other students, or, you know, and just really feeling that sense of ownership. And that really rang true reading your book, how, you know, that could translate into home life. I thought that was really interesting. So, I mean, I guess just starting with that connection sort of pillar of the apprenticeship model, What sorts of examples could you give of how that would differ maybe from maybe traditional discipline models that we're used to?
Right. So in the traditional discipline models, if a child's doing something wrong, I'm making air quotes, then we focus on how do we motivate them to want to do it more with a punishment or a reward. So it's a very top-down model where the adult's in charge and we're really manipulating the child to get the outcome we want. And instead, in the apprenticeship model, you're going to try to connect with your child so that they can hear you, because kids who are activated, who are being punished or being scolded or who know they did something wrong, they're going to have a, you know, their amygdala is going to be acting up. They're not going to be using the prefrontal cortex of their brain, which is where their logical thought and problem solving is. So the connection helps to actually get them to hear you. Otherwise, there's no use, right? They're not able to process what you're saying logically. And then the step two is the communication. So sharing what you're seeing and hearing what they intended or why they did what they did. And that is so important because often our kids aren't trying to be bad. They're, in fact, I would argue they're really never trying to be bad. They have something else going on, either that they had a different idea in mind or that they just don't have that skill yet. So for example, you know, we, and this is just a very basic thing where, you know, our kids walk in the home from school, they drop their backpack in the middle of the front hallway, and then they're so anxious to go get their snack or go play with the dog that they have some agenda that is not about hanging up a backpack. And that's just a kid's mindset. They're not going to be doing usually step one, step two, step three. They're going to go right to the fun. And so to solve that problem, instead of reprimanding them, either punishing them for the backpack or creating like a reward system where if they hang up their backpack five times, they get a prize. You know, if we instead bring them into conversation and say, you know, why it's dangerous, the next person who comes in might trip. You know, we have these nice hooks that we took so much time to hang up and come up with a system that will work for them to remember to hang up their backpack. Or as I did with my daughter, Ava, sometimes if the communication vocally doesn't work, put a little sticker on the backpack or a post-it note that says, "Dear Ava, I don't like lying down on the ground. Please hang me up, love, your backpack." You know? And that triggers their sense of fun and play. It's not confrontational. And that helps them then to create a new habit of hanging it up. And so you don't have the conflict, you don't have the power struggle, and you're building your kids' skills. So that's kind of in a nutshell how it differs.
Well, one incident you were writing about that I thought really illustrated this for me, there was a morning where I think you were supposed to go get bagels if your daughters were up by a certain time. And then that didn't end up happening for various reasons. And you write at the end, sort of we see this whole scene unfold, and I'll let you share that. But you sort of end up giving at the end insight that later in the day, you know, this discussion would happen and these consequences would happen, but it didn't happen in the moment. And I thought that was just a really powerful illustration of this model. Could you talk about that encounter a little bit?
Right. So as I remember it, if it's the one I'm thinking of, one of the kids was ready on time. So I usually, on occasion, if we're, you know, we have the money and the time, I'll say if everyone's ready by 7:30, we can stop by the bagel place on the way to school. And then that's a firm 7:30. It's not 7:31. And our kids have learned that we really mean it. And yet they still get upset. So as I recall, one of the kids was ready and was like ready to go. And the other one was dawdling and then just got totally upset. And there was some throwing and bad language. And I can hold that limit. And I did without being myself triggered or getting upset or yelling back, because I recognize my child's in that fight or flight state, right? They're activated, they're angry, they don't have their best self forward. And it's really tempting in that situation to want to rescue the kids, to especially the child who was doing everything right. And you sort of feel like, why should they suffer? Why should they have to miss the fun trip? But it's important to hold the consequence, and you can't always make a special exception. And then the other thing I would say is it really shows the kids that I have faith that they can handle those big emotions, that they're not going to melt. They don't need to be rescued from feeling bad. And then we do always try to follow up with a conversation about, hey, this morning, you just really lost it. You know, what was that like for you? So that they tune in, they can process the experience. They can start to understand in their own bodies what it feels like when they start to get activated, when they instantly get frustrated and kind of flip their lid. And that's the first step. That awareness is the first step to then managing their emotions. And it's a long process, you know, for children to learn to manage their big emotions, but it cannot happen without that awareness. And parents can be such a force for good if we help them to process, to reflect, to really understand themselves and to understand our household limits, and that we're not going to budge just because they're having a tantrum. And the last thing I would say is, so often we do have that impulse, like, to twist the knife a little bit when they're feeling the consequence of their decisions, and that is not productive. So if we are just calm ourselves, we don't say, I told you so, we don't say, you should have just gotten it together a minute earlier, then the learning happens. They're not angry at us, you know, unduly for something that we added to that tough experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I thought was powerful about that, I think there had been some sort of, you know, tantrum or things had gotten knocked over and things like that. And you, I think sometimes it can be tempting as a parent or a teacher to feel like you have to solve everything in the moment and deliver consequences in the moment and confront them in the moment. And you write about how, you know, you ended up leaving on a positive moment, but saying, you know, later that day when you got home, you know, she would have to clean up the mess and you'd have a conversation about it and she'd lose a certain amount of screen time, but she'd be much more able to hear that and process that and have it be more of a learning opportunity later on, as opposed to, as you're saying, when she is sort of in the heat of the moment and still, you know, feeling all those feelings. I thought, you know, it can be helpful for, I think, a parent too, to be able to have a calm conversation later when you're not worked right. up, and that it doesn't all have to be solved in that moment. A perception, I'm sure you've maybe had pushback, like, oh, are we just going easier on our kids if we use that method? And I think, you know, in that instance, I think that's showing that it's more just changing the approach, but I don't think you're necessarily going easier on anyone per se.
Yeah. And people, you know, do say to me, and actually a relative recently said to me, is that behavior okay? So that behavior is just okay then. And, you know, it's not like I'm endorsing behavior by, you know, witnessing it. It's happening. It's going to happen. Kids are going to have meltdowns. They're going to kick. They're going to scream. They're going to curse. They're going to say to their parents, I hate you. I wish you weren't my mommy. And that's just part of growing up. So if we make those emotions not okay, are we sending our kids the message that they have to stuff down their emotions and not feel them? Because that's not healthy. You know, the behavior is what we want to focus on. And, you know, that's what we want to do, you know, approach in a moment when there is a possibility for learning. We sort of think our kids are like dogs that have to be trained with the treat the instant that they do something. And humans are not animals like that. They can actually, we have higher order brain functions. We should take the opportunity to use them by talking to our kids in a moment when they can be their best selves and really learn from the experience, instead of thinking that they were just like going to train them with a reward and a punishment at the second that something happens, and somehow we're supposed to be perfectly in charge. That's just not consistent with the messiness of life and raising kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the other things that really appealed to me, I really felt like the families you were profiling, some of them in particular, were really setting high standards for their kids, and in terms of the way they'd contribute around the house, and even in terms of some of that limit setting you were talking about and being really clear with, like, family consequences. Is there a family in particular you'd want to highlight where you really, you know, were sort of inspired by their parenting style and how that was benefiting their kids?
Oh, yes, definitely. The Jackson family in Vermont. I went up to learn about Vicki Hofel's model of parent education, which is kind of best, I think, explained in her book, Duct Tape Parenting. And I met Bay and Josiah Jackson, and they had 2 4-year-old twins and a 7-year-old who were younger. I think at the time my kids were maybe 6 and 8. So, and those kids were doing so much around the house. They were making their own lunches, helping fold laundry, helping with the dishes and the cooking. And even this 4-year-old girl was cutting walnuts with a big sharp knife for her snack. So the kids were really capable and they took such pride in doing it that I came home, you know, ready to sort of take another run at chores with our family. And it was really successful because kids are so able to help and they want to, as you were saying in the library, they want to do these adult things. They want to shelf books, they want to cook meals, and it gives them a deep sense of satisfaction and self-worth to be able to learn to do it. Instead of us saying, oh, no, I'm faster, I'm neater, I'm going to do it now. And then someday in the future, you'll be ready. We have to let them take those baby steps. And you're in a great position with a little one to start when they still have that eagerness to help, I do it myself, and know they're not going to be able to do it perfectly or even maybe help at all at that age. But if they have that sense of contributing, then soon by the time they're 5 or 6 or 8, they will really be helping to lighten the load and making a sibling a meal or helping making themselves food. And it's just such a wonderful gift to give our kids that opportunity to contribute.
I think that's so true. And, you know, even so my daughter's a year and a half, but she'll even be thrilled, you know, handing me the silverware out of the dishwasher as we're unloading it, you know, or just learning how to, you know, take off your shoes and put them away and little things like that. Even, you know, a really young child will, I think, be really proud of themselves and be able to do some things. And you have a really helpful list in the back of the book of just, you know, age appropriate chore ideas for kids. And I think it's helpful to see because, I don't have an older child yet, but I think sometimes we might underestimate their abilities. I mean, you have on here for kids 6 to 8 years old to be, you know, able to, you know, pack their own lunch, you know, clean a bathroom, things like that. I think it is kind of inspiring to think about really helping make them as capable as we can.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah, my eyes were opened. And, you know, I was not in a I'm not in a profession where I spend a lot of time with little kids. So I sort of didn't myself know how much they could do.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. So for somebody who is interested, obviously, you know, pick up the book or get it at your local library. But I guess what would be, you know, just some first tips for parents of school age kids and then maybe, you know, younger kids like toddlers that you would suggest just, you know, baby steps for starting out with this apprenticeship model?
Oh, that's a great question. So definitely number one is connection. You know, focus on connecting before you start worrying about discipline. And I think that you'll find if you do more of the one-on-one special time with kids where they're directing the activity, even just for like 10 or 15 minutes with a very young child or a school-aged child, that suddenly gives them, their behavior often will improve just when you set aside that time, when you make a point and tell them it's on the calendar. And, you know, that fills their bucket so that then they're much more willing to cooperate with you. And that's the first great step.
And you're not distracted looking at your phone or trying to do work or, yeah, I think that's a really good point.
Non-screen connection opportunity. And then the second thing I would say is to really try to be aware of your own reaction and what's driving you know, your behavior. And I do think so often as parents, we have this idea of what our kids should be doing. And that if they're not, if they're throwing a tantrum or they're not picking up after themselves or they're rude to someone, it's our fault because somehow they're a reflection on us. So if we can notice our own narrative and what is getting us revved up, then we can really challenge that and say, okay, is it that my child is a future juvenile delinquent who's going to be living in a van down by the river, or do they just not have that skill yet? And take the heat and emotion out of it from our side. So that really comes down to us self-regulating and making sure we're taking a few deep breaths before we respond. We're getting enough sleep and exercise and all those other healthy things so we can be at our best as parents. And if I can say a third thing, I would also say, you know, please all of us just take the judgment out of it. Don't get so worried about the moment we're in, because however old your child is, they're going to be older next year and the year after that, and the stakes will be higher and the problems will be bigger and the consequences could be worse. So, you know, don't feel that this moment, you know, is so precious that we have to get it right now. Let yourself be a little messy and mess up and take a stab at it and learn, because we need to have that courage to be imperfect so that our kids can be themselves messy, and that we can have those tough conversations with our kids or impose the consequences that may be hard, and, you know, be willing to be brave as parents, because I think so often we're driven by fear and worry about the judgment of other parents, and that's not healthy for us or for our kids.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really valuable point. One other question I had. So, you know, for a new parent who, you know, hasn't really developed any particular habits around language with their kids, because I think a lot of what struck me is in that communication pillar, just the way we talk to our kids around praise or in terms of correcting behavior. You know, if you're trying to really, you know, start off on a good foot and really be using positive language and positive discipline, I guess what would some tips starting out be in terms of just the way we phrase things to our kids?
Oh, I love this question. So the broad principle here is, whenever possible, you're going to be asking your child to use their own judgment and their own critical thinking. So instead of saying, good job, I like how you did that, you're making me happy, have them reflect, you know, oh my gosh, how did you choose those colors for that picture? Or, you know, what do you think is the first step to putting on your shoes? Why don't you show me? So having them really be the actor instead of us being so in charge, and really focusing on the process rather than the result, which is, there's so much research on the growth mindset and how the more that we show kids how they can grow and change and improve, the more motivated they're going to be to do that. And, you know, really, whenever possible, instead of saying no, try to flip it and make it positive. So no, instead of saying no, we can't go to the park until you've cleaned up the playroom, as soon as the toys are put away, then we can go to the park. So whenever we can flip a negative into a positive, instead of saying, don't run, we say, please walk, or use the scissors safely, or, you know, positive phrasing, whatever we can. And really, don't make our kids responsible for our emotions. This was one of my big mistakes early in parenting. You're stressing me out, or your fighting isn't giving me a headache, or all these things where I'm blaming my experience on them. And that just teaches our kids not to take responsibility for your own emotions. So that's another big one that I had to learn.
I think that's a powerful one that struck me as well. I guess to give one more example of this method in action, I will throw out a scenario that I see quite often as the parent of a toddler. You know, you're out at a playgroup or the library, and inevitably there is going to be a struggle between kids over someone's taking someone else's toy, or really it's no one's toy because it's, you're at a public place, and there's issues around sharing. And I feel like there's always a debate amongst parents of, you know, how involved do we get, and you know, is this a teachable moment or are we having them work it out themselves? So I'm curious with this model, what that approach would be in a scenario where kids are fighting over toys or having trouble sharing.
That's such a good question. And that is one of the toughest situations in public because the kids don't have a relationship. They don't really know each other or know each other's boundaries. And you don't really know the other parents. So I always advise parents when you're going to the playground or a library or somewhere public to start with making those connections to begin with. So even if it's just like saying hi to the other parents, oh, how old is your child? I'm so-and-so, you know, introduce yourself, find some basis for connection so that when the inevitable dispute arises, you'll be more on a team and more able to, you know, say, hey, you know, looks like maybe they could work it out and give them an extra 30 seconds. So it doesn't mean we don't intervene at all, but just stretch it a little bit, give them a chance first to see if they can work it out and see it as a very long-term process that, you know, especially with someone you don't know, you don't want them to bop another kid over the head. And so you may need to just grab something out of their hands, but to take a pause, a moment before you intervene and try to stretch your tolerance and their tolerance. And then if you're in a play group or siblings or cousins or neighborhood friends, that's a really great opportunity to agree with the other parents on, hey, can we let the kids work it out and only come to us if they haven't been able to find a solution, and allow a little bit of violence, you know, a little bit of shoving, a little bit of grabbing, and crying. And that's sometimes the way that kids learn the fastest is, mm-hmm. you know, it's like we're not going to be able to play anymore because you pushed each other and everyone's crying. And then the fun ends. And many kids need to experience that a few times before they learn, oh, gosh, every time we fight, we have to leave. So I guess maybe I should not fight.
Well, you know, it goes back to what you were saying at the beginning and what we were talking about in terms of the benefits of just kid-directed play, because one of the things they do learn are those, you know, those social interactions and those skills. And, you know, I can see that if we're jumping in all the time, then they're maybe not learning that. And then where does it end? You know, you make that point with a lot of things. When do we stop intervening?
Right. And it's a dynamic system. So you'll learn also like how long you can wait before intervening or what your kids are capable of if you just take a step back. Doesn't mean you have to disappear, but just to have a bias in favor of letting them try to work it out before you jump in.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Well, if people want to find out more, this is going to air in the new year. And if they want to find out more about you or follow, I know you have some events coming up.
Yes, the website katherinerlewis.com is the best place. I have a list of my events, and I'd love to meet listeners in person if I'm coming to your town. And also, of course, love to connect with people on social media, and all of my, you know, handles are on that website as well. And my phone number, if anyone wants to call me. So thank you so much for suggesting that.
Yeah. And just to end, I love to hear from authors in particular, books that you've been reading lately, or even in your case, if there's any books you want to recommend, if people read The Good News about Bad Behavior and then want to keep reading about this topic. Are there any recommendations you'd want to make to listeners for something to read next?
Oh, sure. Well, let's see. Julie Lithcott-Hames has an amazing book called How to Raise an Adult. And that's sort of the next level of, you know, the high school, college age, but a lot of the same principles. And she's just a beautiful writer and very smart. I was inspired by that book. I'm currently reading Crossing the Safety by Wallace Stegner, rereading it because I'm in a nostalgic period about my own grandparents who were academics and, from Wisconsin. So,
I've heard such great things about that book. It's been on my to be read list for a long time and I haven't gotten to it. So
yeah, I love that book. And what else was I just reading? The Incendiaries. I know a lot of people read it this summer by R.O. Kwan. I'm just in the middle of, and An American Marriage by Tyra.
Oh, that was so good.
Just finished it and like cried my way through it. So
I listened to the audio of that one, and that was really well done.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. Well, I'll definitely link to all those in the show notes. I think your book was just such an interesting read. So I hope people go pick up The Good News About Bad Behavior, or head over to their local library. And I'm just so glad I got to speak with you. This was really wonderful to get to talk with you more about it.
Oh, I loved it too. Thank you so much for having me on.
To learn more about The Good News About Bad Behavior, you can head over to Catherine's website, CatherineRLewis.com, and there you'll also find links to follow her on social media. For links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode, you can head to the show notes at abookishhome.com. And if you're enjoying the podcast, it would be so helpful if you could share it with a friend or subscribe. If you could take a moment to rate and review on iTunes, that would also really help people find the show. To stay up to date on A Bookish Home happenings, you can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at A Bookish Home. Thanks for listening and happy reading!